This is Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. I'm John Hansen. All right, Illinois Governor Pritzker signed a new bill into law on Thursday that bars police from lying to underage kids during interrogations. This was a bipartisan-supported bill that went through. This is the first state in the nation now. Illinois will be doing that. And here to chat about that a little bit is Laura Nyreiter. She's a co-director on the Center of Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern's Law School. Laura, thanks for hopping on with us here today.
Absolutely, John. Thanks so much for having me.
It's very rare we get bipartisan support for anything, so I like to celebrate it when we get it. But this bill was not only supported by politicians, but police associations as well, right?
That's right. Yeah, this is the first bill in the country, as you said, to prohibit police from lying to children during interrogations, which is a common sense reform that's long overdue. This bill was supported by folks from both sides of the aisle, also by the Illinois Chiefs of Police, by the Illinois State's Attorney Association, and by law enforcement trainers who train police all across the state how to question kids. So I'm so proud that this reform has really garnered, as you say, this rare moment of bipartisanship.
We should celebrate it when it happens. So when you just say the sentence, oh, yeah, they can't lie to kids anymore, I think a lot of people will go, well, yeah, of course not. They shouldn't do that. It's a little bit more nuanced than that, though, right? Because obviously you could have different interpretations of what lying is, what not. So I guess I want to ask from the beginning, What do you mean by lying? What has been done in interrogations that would qualify as lying that this bill now says you can't do that anymore?
Sure, absolutely. So this bill prohibits two specific interrogation tactics, both of which stem from deception, that have been used in Illinois and around the country for decades, right? These are psychological interrogation tactics that are designed, of course, to get confessions. The types of deception that this bill prohibits. The first category is lies about the evidence.
Okay.
So often when an interrogation is happening, right, you bring the suspect into the room, the police officer walks in and confronts the suspect with an accusation, right? We believe you committed X crime because we found your DNA at the scene, or we found your fingerprints on the gun, or there are three witnesses in the room next door who picked you out of a lineup. Those kinds of claims about evidence might be true, but they also might be false. Police are allowed to lie about the evidence against a suspect during interrogation. It's all part of the first phase of interrogation designed to bring a suspect down to a place of hopelessness. There's this mountain of evidence against you. You're trapped. You're cornered. No one will believe you if you say you're innocent, right? And then the second stage of interrogation kicks in, and this is the second category of deception that this bill is targeting. Once that suspect is brought down to a place of hopelessness, you're caught, you're trapped, you're cornered, there's this mountain of evidence against you, whether there actually is or isn't, then officers are trained to come in and say, well, look, you know, I can see you feel like you're in a corner. Listen, if you don't confess, people will think you're remorseless. No one will have any sympathy for you, right? You'll get the book thrown at you. The judge will dislike you. The jury will have no sympathy. And you're going to go down for life or some lengthy term of years.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do confess, people will see you're a good guy. People will see that you have remorse, that you want to cooperate, that you want to atone for what you've done. And in that case, maybe you just get a couple of years in prison. So it's these two categories of lies, lies about the evidence, and lies about the consequences of confessing.
Interesting. And this is for people under the age of 18. I imagine there's some people out there that would argue that this should apply to all adults as well. But this is a start because, boy, I think the tables have turned over the last 5 to 10 years, partly because of a case involving one of the folks that you've worked with, a high-profile case on Making a Murderer on Netflix. I think for a long time we thought if someone confesses, they are guilty, without a doubt. Why would anyone confess if they're not guilty? We've learned a lot in the last 10 years, haven't we?
We've learned a ton about this sort of fascinating question, right? Why would anyone confess to a crime if they didn't commit the crime, right? Especially something as heinous as murder, which you're right. My client, Brendan Dassey, whose story was profiled in the Netflix series Making a Murderer a few years ago, is exactly one such person. We know of hundreds of cases around the country in which people have confessed to crimes that DNA later proved beyond the shadow of a doubt that they did not commit. Here in Illinois, we have 100 false confession cases that have come to light so far. It's earned us the nickname, the false confession capital of the country.
Wait, so when you say we have 100, this means that these have been proven to be wrong by DNA or some evidence that show. It's not just, oh, maybe this is in doubt. These are ones that have been proven to be wrong.
That's right. These are proven false confessions, confessions that have been proven false by DNA testing, forensic evidence, fingerprint testing, whatever the case may be. So we know of 100 such cases here. And of that 100, 31 of those confessions were given by children under age 18. We know that kids are especially vulnerable to these interrogation tactics. They can't see through the deception, right? They're not equipped to understand when they're being lied to and when they're not being lied to. And we know that kids are between 2 and 3 times as likely to falsely confess as adults.
Why have these tactics been okay? I guess this is sort of a question of, I know a lot of people that would say, I cannot believe police officers have done this or detectives have done this, how incredibly bad this is. But this is how a lot of them have been trained, and it works.
No, you're exactly right. A lot of them have been trained to do exactly this. So, you know, back in the old days, about 100 years ago, right, when interrogations would happen, they involved physical abuse back in the day, right? People were just kind of roughed up, beaten up, whatever the case may be, until they got a confession. So about 75 years ago, in the 40s and 50s, a new set of psychological interrogation techniques was developed, actually, at Northwestern Law, which is where I now teach. And at the time, these psychological techniques, which revolved a lot around the use of deception, were thought of as really progressive and really enlightened because, of course, they replaced physical abuse. So those techniques developed in the 40s and 50s are still in use today, are still taught to officers all across the state and all across the country in all 50 states. But since the 40s and 50s, of course, right, something really important has happened. And that's the invention of DNA technology, because all of a sudden we can use DNA to test whether these confessions are true. And thanks to DNA, we are learning that people are falsely confessing at a rate much higher than anyone would have ever thought, and under circumstances that are different than we'd previously thought. It's these psychological interrogation techniques that are just as coercive, just as risky as the old physical abuse, the old third degree techniques that were in use 100 years ago. So this bill takes a huge step at eliminating the most risky psychological techniques, those that rely on deception, while still leaving in place other interrogation techniques that are proven to be more reliable in getting statements from guilty people. Right? We'll still be able to solve crimes, still be able to get confessions. We'll just eliminate this risky tactic of deception.
When you say risky, is it because you might get a false one, the killer or whatever, the person who did it, who actually did the crime, gets to walk free, and that could mean potential for other things? Does it save cities and states from potential lawsuits in the future? Like, I'm trying to see, like, why the Illinois chiefs would get, or why police would get behind this, because some people would say this takes a tool out of their tool chest.
Totally, right. It takes a tool out of the tool chest, but the problem is this tool carries with it a high risk of false confessions, and it's not needed to get statements from guilty people. That's why we got the support of the chiefs of police and the state's attorneys association. You know, when someone falsely confesses to a crime and is wrongfully convicted on the basis of that confession, that means that the real perpetrator is still out there on the streets. And, you know, we had testimony actually in the legislature in support of this bill from a man named Terrell Swift, a former client of ours at the Center on Wrongful Conviction, one of the so-called Englewood Four, a group of teenage boys who confessed to a murder that DNA 15 years later proved that they didn't commit. And in their case, turned out when that DNA was finally tested, finally identified, it belonged to a serial rapist.
Wow.
And murderer who had terrorized the Englewood neighborhood while these teenagers were languishing in prison. So, you know, at the end of the day, wrongful convictions, it's a public safety issue. Nobody wants an innocent person behind bars. Nobody wants the guilty person out roaming the streets. And that's why we were so proud to partner with law enforcement on this.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people that assume the police just want, oh, they want someone in jail so that they can say, oh, we did it. And there might be some elements of truth to that, and there's circumstances where that's the case. But I think that 99% of police officers out there want the criminals that committed the crime to be the one in jail and not an innocent person. Laura, please stay on the line. We're going to put you on quick hold. And Carrie, stay on the line, too, because you've got a really great question. This is Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. John Hansen here hosting Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Illinois, the first state in the nation to outlaw police interrogations of folks under the age of 18, at least for them to lie in a police interrogation, either about evidence or about consequences. Laura Nyreiter joining us from the Center of Wrongful Conviction from Northwestern Law School. And Laura, you don't mind if I take a quick call? We have a great question on the line. And this is coming from Carrie. Carrie, you're on WGN.
Hey, Jen. Hey, yeah, this is a really complicated question to discuss. I mean, just because now, I mean, just because you're a minor, you know, 12-year-old, 13-year-olds are doing really bad stuff.
Right.
But that aside, so rather than changing the legislature, wouldn't it be easier just to require that a parent, guardian, or an adult relative or an attorney needs to be present before the police were able to even attempt this? That sounds easier to me than changing the whole, you know,
right,
making laws.
Or in conjunction with it. I mean, like, that could be...
Or in conjunction, yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Laura, any thoughts on that? Why isn't that required?
Well, I think, Carrie, I think you're spot on. You know, it's only about 13 states around the country, believe it or not, that require police even to notify a parent before questioning a child. And I say that as a mom of two boys, that troubles me to no end, and it should trouble any parent in the country. You know, Illinois did pass a law a few years ago, one of the first such laws, again, in the country, that requires lawyers in the interrogation room for kids, but only very, very young kids, 13 and younger, and only in the most serious of cases. So very few kids really are protected by this law. It needs to be expanded. Those two, I think, are common sense reforms that anybody who's a parent, anybody who knows a kid, you know, just understands how important that is.
Carrie,
seems like common sense.
Yeah, but you know, you can't always trust common sense in Washington or Springfield. So, Carrie, we appreciate the phone call. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks, John. Love it.
Absolutely, Laura. I wanted to ask: should this be the case? Should this law apply to adults too? Do you anticipate
Absolutely.
That happening eventually? Maybe.
Absolutely. It should apply to everyone, right? To everyone across the country. Illinois was the first. Oregon was right on our heels. Oregon signed a similar bill into law prohibiting deception with kids over there. And New York is currently considering a law as well that would prohibit the use of deception during interrogations, not just with kids, but also with adults. So, you know, I look forward to expanding these protections. We got to do it incrementally sometimes, which is fine. Let's get the ball moving. Let's show that we don't need these tactics to solve crimes, and let's expand these protections as much as we can.
I want to dive in just a little bit deeper, just in case, you know, just to really put a fine point on it. And I know you get asked a lot about Brandon Dassey, and feel free to use his example here too. But I mean, we're talking about getting confessions out of people where often police interrogators, to kind of fill in the blanks, they feed information to someone. I mean, that is a prime example. If there's one thing to show that someone didn't commit the crime, it's when they don't know any of the details of the crime.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's precisely what happened in the case of Brendan Dassey, as well as so many other false confession cases. They all follow a very similar pattern, right? So Brendan, who is, you know, again, in the Netflix series Making a Murderer, my client Brendan was 16 years old at the time when he was questioned back in 2006. He was a special education student with an IQ right around 70. And he's questioned four times over a period of 48 hours with no parents, no lawyer, about a murder that had taken place the year before. And the police, it's all captured on videotape and audio tape, every single word that transpires. And the police tell him, you know, they bring him into the interrogation room on the first go-round, and they tell him that the DA is looking at charging him with murder or having something to do with the murder, which was a complete lie, right? Mm. No one was looking at Brendan for anything because there was no evidence that he was involved. But they tell him that the DA is looking at charging him with murder. And they tell him, just as you said, John, that he needs to fill in the blanks. He needs to make himself look a little bad. And that if he does that, right, people will want to help him. He's going to be okay. He's going to be all right. He's going to have nothing to worry about. you know, the cops are going to make sure he's not left high and dry, so on and so on and so on. And, you know, you got a 16-year-old special education student there in the box, and eventually Brendan realizes that they want him to say he participated in this murder. And over the course of the next, these four interrogations, you know, there's Brendan trying to describe participating in a murder and utterly failing. This is a tragic case of a young woman who was killed by she was shot in the head. That's how she was killed. And the interrogators ask Brendan to describe, you know, this murder. And he guesses every which way you can think of killing somebody. Did we stab her? Did we, you know, punch her? Did we choke her? At one point, he's so confused, he says, well, we killed her by cutting off her hair. And he can't come up with the right answer, so they have to feed it to him. Brendan, you know, you shot her in the head. It's a classic, classic sign of a false confession. And frankly, you don't have to be a lawyer to recognize, you know, when that happens, when you've got a kid who does not know what he's talking about. Brendan, as I said, those interrogations were back in 2006 when he was 16. He was convicted on the basis of those confessions and nothing else in 2007. And he remains in prison, tragically, to this day. We got within about 12 hours of getting him out a few years ago.
Yeah, I remember that, because he was
sure blocked it. Yeah.
Where does that case stand now?
We're still working on it, still fighting. You know, at the Center on Wrongful Convictions, we've exonerated about 45 people over the course of our history and gotten, you know, secured the release of dozens more. And we know that these cases sometimes take 5 years, sometimes take 10 years, sometimes take 15 years of legal work, because the system is designed so much to keep those prison doors closed. And you are just, you know, walking up a mountaintop, up the side of a mountain to try and pry those doors open. So we are still working on the case every day. Still very much believe in Brendan Dassey, as might I add, does the rest of the world.
Yeah. Laura, thank you for all your work. I'm glad that we are on the right side of this here in Illinois. Laura Nyreiter from the Center of Wrongful Conviction at Northwestern Law School, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate giving us some time here on the Saturday afternoon. That's going to do it for Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. News next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.